list of contents of things I hope I'll be able to discuss. So let's start at the beginning. What is it that we really want, right? It'd be great if we could have a gravity description of QCD. We could calculate anything we wanted in QCD as strong coupling. This is, of course, difficult, but there has been progress recently. We don't have a theory of, don't have a theory of QCD, of gravity, but we do have other similar theories like N equals 4 super young Mills, and that's related to string theory in ABS 5 process 5. And N equals 4 is not QCD, but it's not that different either. There's been progress in studying real QCD by studying N equals 4 in some way. So there are some limits in which these theories are similar. Can you hear me? Yeah, okay. Well, quark, gluon, plasma is one example in which we studied QCD at high temperatures, so conformality is no longer an issue. And so if we put N equals 4 at some high temperature, then theory is not conformal anymore, and it's not so different from QCD. Another example is the transcendentality hypothesis, in which, well, if we calculate some quantities like the Kasper anomalous dimensions, and we just look at the most transcendental piece, it turns out that the answer in N equals 4 and QCD actually match. So we can calculate if things are related to QCD physics by using the ABS-DFT correspondence. So how do we take this further? So there's been, of course, recent applications in condensed matter physics and viscosity to entropy ratio proposals. And the question is, with the LHC coming up, what kind of things we can do in conformal, in collider physics type of applications. So one question we can ask is how new physics and QCD will look inside an accelerator. So I'll give a short introduction to what conformal collider physics is. So the first question is, well, what can we calculate? What should we calculate? And of course, fair objection is that the theory is conformal, so what are we going to do about that? So, well, as I said, many properties of QCD depend only on UV physics. So, conformality is maybe not such a big issue. We can expand perturbatively in the beta function and treat non-conformality perturbatively. There are also phenomenological models in which you have hidden sectors that are conformal. And we can also think of this as just a warm-up for QCD. So if we understand this case better, we might be able to get to QCD at some point. And if these reasons are not still not good enough, it's still a good lab in which to understand the ABS-CFT conjecture in a better way. So what do we calculate then? There's been recent progress in understanding how to calculate gauge theory amplitudes in ABS-CFT. And the problem with these observables is that they are not IR safe, meaning that they have to be regularized, and these quantities depend on the scheme which we use. So a natural IR safe observable is one I'll discuss today, which is the energy correlator, energy correlation functions. And we usually think of these quantities in a perturbative way. We calculate S-matrix elements, we calculate the cross-sections. We think of this in the Parton model. But I want to discuss another way of thinking about these things that does not rely on a Parton description and thus will be useful in the strong coupling limit. So this is kind of observable that I want to discuss. So this is the energy, endpoint energy correlation functions. So what I'll be doing physically is you can think of, having some experiments, some event inside the collider, and you will be measuring the energy at some large distance from your event, and you'll integrate over all time. So we're going to measure the total energy deposited in the calorimeter at some angle from the experiment. These things we're going to average over all events. So this is not the energy of one event, the energy distribution of one event, but it's just the average over all events. So these are the kind of operators that we're going to consider, and these are the energy correlation functions. O is just the operator that generates our state, and I'll discuss scalar operators, currents, and the energy momentum tensor as sources for our conformal field theory. So one disclaimer is that our calorimeters interact directly with the CFT. So if you really had a hidden CFT sector and you wanted to see how that would look in the LHC, you would have to model how the CFT interacts with the standard model and how the CFT modes decay into standard model modes that you actually detect. So there's an analogy between these kind of things and how to understand how PCD looks like in a detector, in which you have to go from the UV physics to, through hadronization and then to the detector. So, what we'll do is just look at the CFT. We can, because the theory is conformal, we can use a conformal map to change coordinates. And what we'll do is we'll go to coordinates in which the infinite boundary at which we look at the energy, we'll map it at some finite position. So there will be no limits involved. Makes calculations much easier. So in this coordinates, the quantity that we want to calculate is this, which is the energy, integrated energy. So we fix y plus equals 0. Then we'll integrate over the whole boundary. And then we fix this operator sum position in the transverse space. It turns out that we only need one component of the energy momentum tensor, which is t minus minus in these coordinates. And all other components of the form momentum can also be expressed as a function of t minus minus. And this is what you would expect in a theory of massless particles. And it turns out to be true for CFTs and even for interacting CFTs. So this is a nice feature. We'll assume throughout that this quantity is positive, meaning that the energy that you measure at some angle, at some calorimeter, will always be positive. I mean, this might seem rather obvious, but the expectation value of the energy at one point in spacetime is not positive for quantum theory. So I'll assume that the integral over this light-like direction will be. And this has a very physical meaning, that we cannot measure a negative energy in our detector after, you know, we let the experiment evolve. The same thing I did for the energy, I can do for charges, so I can define a charge and a correlator in the same way. So what are the general results for a CFT? So let's first talk about what happens when we consider two insertions of the energy operator that are very close together, and we want to look at how this behaves at small angles. So we know there's a small angle divergence. You can see this perturbatively, and it's related to collinear radiation, which I don't see. I don't know if you can see, but that's what that graph is. And it turns out that we're trying to compute the OPE of these two operators. And that means we're trying to look for a spin three operator of leading twist. So at zero coupling, you can have n equals four super young mills in mind in this slide. These are the type of operators that we're going to consider. And these are a family of local operators, primary operators, but they're only primary for even J. So we want to generalize this for odd J or even complex J. So a family of operators that does the job is this one, which amounts to joining two adjoint fields by a Wilson line. And these are called light ray operators. And well, it turns out that the operator we're looking for is this, which this just means that we're integrating we're fully transforming to zero momentum. That's all this is. So these are the operators that appear on the right-hand side, and these are the operators responsible for these divergences. We can actually calculate the exact operators if we have a precise theory. For example, for n equals 4 at weak coupling, we know how to diagonalize all operators that appear of this type. We just have to diagonalize the matrix phenomenal dimensions, and then we can write the exact operators that appear in the OPE. So from this point of view, the divergences at small angle are related to the existence of these states of these operators in the theory. There are non-local operators. That's what's interesting about them. They're smeared out over a light-like line. So let's calculate some things. Let's see what we can say about CFT for different cases. So let's be not too ambitious, and let's start with a one-point function. So this is the object that we want to calculate. We can think of O first as a scalar operator. So let's do that first. And one thing that we notice is that the one-point function of the energy amounts to calculating a three-point function in the field theory. And there's an unusual time ordering from the point of quantum field theory. We usually think of time order correlators because we're calculating S matrix elements. But in this case, what we will do is we'll first consider this operator, then the energy. And then we'll go back in time to the first operator, which is what we do when we consider the expectation value of something, which is, you know, like having an in state and then some operator in between. So we have to keep that in mind. And it turns out that for the one-point functions, in most cases, O3 symmetry is enough. We don't need the whole conformal symmetry. O3 symmetry will be enough in most cases. So for a scalar source, the result is that this function is just uniform. It does not depend on the angle at which I'm measuring the energy. And one way to see this is that this is fixed by the Ward identities. The Ward identities relate the coefficients from the three-point functions to coefficients in the two-point functions. And for a scalar, there's only one structure, and so that's only that the only structure that appears has to be related to the two-point function. So there's no there's nothing free. So this has to be it. Now we can think of current sources, and one thing to keep in mind. Do I have a chart here? So one thing to keep in mind for this is the kind of thing that we're doing. If we think of, you know, some electron coming in. Oh, this here interacts with our CFT. So we can think of these current operators as being, you know, in QCD, for example, it would be having the some electron and emitting a photon and then that interacting with QCD. So it's like thinking of the process to first order in the electron coupling and to all orders in the CFT. So this is a picture you can have in mind for what these current sources actually mean in the CFT. So if we do that, then the result is this. So O3 symmetry fixes this to be this. This is the usual dipole pattern that we're used to seeing. And the energy positivity condition implies that this coefficient here is constrained by these values. So here the Ward identities are not enough to fix all coefficients. This coefficient is free and it's fixed by the energy positivity condition to lie inside this window. And this is true for perturbative QCD. For QCD, this coefficient is -3/2. And you can see that the corrections actually take this value inside the window, not outside it. So for now, n=1 theories are a little bit more interesting. For a non-arc current, this is always zero. This is uniform. And the reason this is so is that fermions and bosons cancel. So whenever you have an excess in a boson channel, the fermion channel will cancel that. So the only interesting thing we can say is something about the R current. And all correlators of the R current can only depend on A and C. A and C are just the central charges of the theory. One is the parts that can appear in the trace of the stress energy tensor. So for free theories, we can calculate, and because we know that this can only depend on A and C, using free theory is actually enough to fix the result for any interacting theory. And it turns out that the result is this. And one interesting consequence is that for n=4 superyang Mills, where A and C are the same, this is uniform. So these are some nice results that we can obtain for current sources. So now the question is, what happens if we go beyond? Let's go to the energy momentum tensor as a source. And now the general structure is again fixed by O3 symmetry, and it's of this form. And we have to fix T2 and T4. And for n=1 theories, it turns out to be this. So again, it can only depend on C and A. And T4 is zero. And we can again impose a condition on a window where T2 has to be inside, because we want the energy to be positive for all angles. And in that case, we obtain a bound for A and the quotient A over C. So this is very interesting. It means that if you're to measure positive energies in this type of experiments, then your theory has to be such that A and C are constrained in this way. A slight detour, which I will not comment too much on, is that this group of people studied Gauss-Poinet gravity, and they found a bound for the coupling in Gauss-Poinet gravity that's based on causality. And they were interested in this because it's related to the viscosity to entropy ratio. And it turns out that the bound they found can be translated to a bound in A over C, and it matches the lower bound that I just explained here. And it's work in progress to try to understand this connection a little bit better, and we have been able to reproduce the higher bound as well in the same setup. And it's interesting to understand this calculation, because if you understand this calculation, you can understand a little bit better why the energy, the positivity of energy condition must hold. So last comment is that for charge correlators, for the anomalous charge correlators, the ones that involve parity odd terms, then O3 symmetry is not enough. So now let's go to the gravity dual of these theories and see what we can say about CFTs in the strongly coupled limit. So we'll use IDS coordinates of this form, in which we have two light-like directions and one H3 of the transverse coordinates. And this is nice because then Lorentz symmetries are isometries of the hyperboloid. And we will insert calorimeters again at W plus equals zero. You can think of W plus as something very similar to Y plus in our old coordinates. And the prescription is that for each energy correlator, we have to insert a factor of this type. It's like the wave function of the graviton that corresponds to the insertion of the energy correlator. And there's an analogous formula for the charge correlator. It's important to notice that this is a delta function in W plus. So this wave function only lives at W plus. And we can do the same for whatever, let's say, scalar field that we send in, and this is the state that we're creating in the conformal field theory. And if we want to stay with definite momentum in the conformal field theory, it turns out that it has to be localized inside the hyperboloid. So we're calculating an overlap between a graviton state that's localized in W plus and a state that's localized in the hyperboloid. So in the end, all we're doing is just taking a snapshot of our particle as it falls through the horizon. W plus corresponds to the horizon in Poincaré coordinates, W plus equals zero. So all we're doing is just taking a snapshot of this state as it falls through the horizon. This is the recipe. If we do that, then we can calculate this energy correlation functions in the gravity dual. So N equals four, the gravity dual to N equals four is just Einstein gravity. And in that case, we know that correlators are uniform. So we want to study the higher derivative corrections to Einstein gravity and see how those affect the energy correlators. So for current sources, we need to consider Einstein-Maxwell theory. And in that case, there's only, you can check that in flat space, there's only two gauge invariant vertices, meaning that there's only two terms in the action that we have to worry about. The rest of them are either equivalent to these ones or field redefinitions. But this is enough to account for all possible vertices in the theory. So this is the usual term plus a higher derivative correction. Here, W is the Weyl tensor. When you do this, you can calculate A2, the same quantity that we discussed before. And it turns out to be this value in ADS. So the way we do these calculations is we do them in flat space, and the terms with the most derivatives turns out to be the same in flat space and ABS. So we can do them in flat space and then translate them to ABS, which is the background that we're interested in. So for a tensor source, there's actually three different vertices, and they're all accounted by this action, where again this is the Weyl tensor. It's a convenient choice, the Weyl tensor. It doesn't mean you have to pick that particular tensor. You can choose for the Riemann tensor. But choosing the Riemann tensor will also change your two-point function, so it makes the calculation more complicated. And it turns out that there's one more R cubed term, but that one does not contribute to the three-point function. So you can play this game again and calculate T2 and T4, and you get these results. It's interesting that, for example, in type 2B string theory, these two terms are not present in the action, and that means that T2 equals zero and T4 equals zero, which is what we found before, that for N equals four super young Mills, T2 equals zero and T4 equals zero. T4 is zero for any theory with N equals one, and T2 is zero only when A equals C, which is the case for N equals four super young Mills. So this is what I explained about flat space to ABS. And we can play the same game and calculate endpoint functions this way. So now I want to talk about how to correct these results with string theory calculations. So what we'll do is we'll play a similar game. We'll try to calculate we're really interested in calculation in ABS, but we'll do it in flat space and then match, try to translate the result to ABS. So the strategy is to calculate in light cone string theory. And this looks this way. We'll have in light cone, we'll have closed string, and then just some insertion here, just some perturbation at, let's say, tau equals zero in a light cone gauge. So this amounts to saying that we're only probing our state at W plus equals zero. That's what we called it before. So it, so the kind of things that we have to calculate are just these brackets, where what we have is just some insertion that doesn't leave over the whole wall sheet, but only inserted at one particular time. And we can do this calculation, for example, for bosonic oscillators, for massless gravitons that contain no bosonic oscillators. And the result, for example, for the two-point function is this. You can do the integrals, and you get this result, which you can expand enough in an alpha prime expansion, and you get this result. So you see that there are alpha prime corrections to the two-point function that you can get this way. One interesting thing is that the first order correction is alpha prime squared. It's not alpha prime. And that, again, is related to the type of corrections you get for type 2V in the effective action. Another thing that's a little bit surprising that you could have worried about is that we're using delta function localized states. And nonetheless, the result is finite. We'll see that that's not the case anymore when we consider charge correlators. So we can translate now this result by going to position space and then using the wave functions that we calculated before through the ADS-CFT correspondence. Let me remind you, these wave functions. And once you insert that result, you can calculate, you can translate the result to ABS, and this is what you obtain. So as you see, there's a correction, and the first correction is like 1 over lambda, not 1 over square root of lambda. And as you see, you already, I mean, from a uniform result, as you go to weaker coupling, you already start seeing some jet-like structure in which the probability of finding particles in the same direction or the opposite direction is higher, and that's why you get this contribution. You can do the same, you can play the same game for endpoint functions, and it turns out that fluctuations are not Gaussian. The three-point function is comparable to a two-point function, not parametrically smaller. So that's an interesting result as well. So for charge correlators, as I said, the delta function generates divergences, and you can see this in field theory already. So again, maybe the lines are kind of weak, but this is the type of diagonal you will calculate for in field theory for charge correlators. And as you see, we have two delta functions that meet at a point, and you get a delta square, and that will give you divergence. The same thing did not happen in gravity, because the gravity waves are exact solutions of the equation of motion. And then there's no vertex like this, and this is a thing that we have to calculate, and we never get a delta square. We would have a term like this if we had a coupling like this with the action. But this makes the result divergent in field theory. So in string theory, the result is not divergent, it's finite. What this means is that the corrections are large enough to compensate for this divergence. So if we calculate this in string theory, we get this result for now a charge correlator. And as we see, it's not infinite, it's actually finite, and it actually vanishes in the low energy limit. So the problem is the problem with the order of the limits. You cannot take the low energy limit first and then do the computation. You have to do the computation and then take the low energy limit. So in a way, the delta function state is forcing string theory on us. We cannot just do the field theory computation. The delta function means that our state is highly localized, and we have to use full string theory to compute and then take the low energy limit. Well, you can see also that opposite charge particles go in opposite directions as you would expect. So you can also extend this story for open strings, and there you also find divergences, and those divergences are also cured by the string theory. So the last thing I want to discuss in detail is the small angle behavior. So we said something about that by studying OPEs in the CFT. And we can do the same now in the string theory. So let's go back to this. This is the result for the two-point function in the string theory. And we know from looking at this expression, from looking at the exact expression, we see that there are some singularities. These singularities we usually associate with states in the string theory, but these are not the usual poles of closed string theory. These are different. They are offset by these two over here. So what really happens is that the states that that are responsible for these poles are not the usual string states, but are some rather non-local states that are responsible. And you can track this difference to the usual integral that appears for string theory computations and the integral that appears in our case. For a usual string theory computation, your insertion can go anywhere on the wall sheet, but in our case, it's localized at time equals zero. So the integral is not over the whole C-plane, but over sigma. And this changes the position of the poles. So what makes these two things different? And how can we reconcile these two results? And the way to do that is just to calculate the usual amplitudes. And you can see that the things that we're calculating are just integrals over S, over the Mandelson parameter S. And it's the regular behavior of these amplitudes that makes them converge. So what all we're really doing is calculating the usual string amplitudes and then integrating over S. And that accounts for the change of the position of the poles, and that accounts for the fact that the amplitudes are convergent when the field theory results were divergent. And this is because of the nice behavior of the string amplitudes in the regular. So we can also understand this from the point of view of the wall sheet OPE. And when we do that, the states that appear are of this type. So this is the one responsible for the first pole. And this is written in light cone gauge, so it's not very illuminating. But from this state, you might be tempted to write this state in conformal gauge. And now here is much more clear what's happening. We have this factor of 3/2, and this is what's making the state non-local. This is what's responsible for this state having a pole at a different position from the usual string states that have integer powers here. So this is the dual string state to the operator that we're discussing on the OPE. This spin 3 operator that was responsible for the divergence at small angles, that was a non-local right lay operator, is related to this string state that's also non-local. So to leading order in lambda, we can calculate the dimension of this operator by just calculating the mass in flat space. And it turns out that this is the dimension of this operator. And you can actually generalize this for arbitrary spin, not just j equals 3, but for any spin, and you get this type of formula. And you can see that these dimensions, they get very large at a strong coupling, which, again, is what you would expect from the operators that you calculate at weak coupling n equals 4. I should say that this formula is only valid for j much less than square root of lambda. If you go beyond this regime, we know this to behave logarithmically. And it's interesting that we can actually find these dual operators and that they turn out to be non-local as well. So let me go to the conclusions. We defined IR safe observables in the conformal field theory through correlation functions. These correlation functions were studied before, but it seems to be that in the literature, it was always studied through a Parton-like description of the theory. This definition of the energy correlation allows for an extension to very strong coupling. This is exactly what I said, that this does not rely on the Partonic description. We found an interesting small angle behavior, and this small angle behavior is related to non-local operators, and you can actually see this in the field theory and in the string theory. And the correlators in the gravity theory are actually calculated by a very simple recipe. It's just taking a snapshot of the states as they cross the horizon. So you can actually calculate these correlators in a simple way in the strong coupling region. And an interesting consequence of all this is that there are bounds on A over C for theories that obey the positivity of energy condition. And this is very interesting because if this ends up being related to causality, as this work suggests, it means that that all conformal theories that we want to study actually have to satisfy this bound. Otherwise, they might run into problems with causality. So future directions are understanding this a little bit better, and this is a work in progress. One thing that you might do is try to study this in a different background that makes it more clear to make the connection between this description and the description we just discussed. You can take this discussion to other dimensions. So for example, you can find condensed matter applications or even discuss IR-free theories. All I said is only true at leaving order in an N. I always discuss the tough limit. So it'd be interesting to calculate 1/n corrections to these results to the string theory correlation function. So one thing that I mentioned at the beginning of the talk is that I'm not considering how the CFT decays into standard model modes or how the non-conformality kicks in. So you could try to add models of hadronization or consider non-conformal theories perturbatively in the coupling parameter. And finally, it'd be interesting to study more complicated initial states. The states that I discuss are states that relate to that picture on the board, where you have something very similar to deep inelastic scattering, if you want to think of it that way. But it'd be also interesting to study states that correspond to, let's say, proton-proton sandwiches. So you'll be calculating the energy correlation function for a state that's actually a proton in the initial state. So that also should be an interesting extension of this work. Thank you.
Any questions? What you described sounds a little bit like unparticle physics. Would you comment on the differences or similarities?
Well, I would say it's a little bit different language. But unparticle physics is just a general framework in which you can describe how to couple a CFT to a standard model. What I just discussed applies to any conformal field theory that you want to consider. If you have a conformal hidden sector, then this would apply to these theories as well. But these are nice observables from the point of view that they relate to collider observables. But these are nice observables per se, just in the theory. I mean, in a theory in which you don't have an S matrix, these are very nice operators in which you can focus on. And you don't need to couple this to any other theory. You can study conformal theory by studying this operator.
All right, well, let's thank Diego again.